From the roots up, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
The Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host, and we're going to do part two of an interview with Zafar Bengash. It'll be coming up in about 30 minutes, and Zafar last week was covering the issue of unfolding events in West Asia, sometimes called the Middle East, and it was apparent to us that we needed to continue on the discussion, and particularly we want to focus today on the matter of the outsized influence of the Gulf monarchies, particularly Qatar. And so we'll be asking him about that, as well as what his analysis of what is currently developing. There's so many shocking things about the business unfolding, business, I guess, is exactly the right word, in Syria and Gaza, and future of Lebanon is very much in question. Jordan, the wrecking crews are very, very busy and destroying, and it's rather like taking down buildings and. These are the United States, Israel, Turkey, et cetera, have obviously agreed on a policy of imposing what they think is going to be a new structure, political structure in the Middle East. The people are obviously, I don't mean one particular movement or another, are going to be resisting, because this is going to be entirely arbitrary. It will be dictated out of Washington. Qatar, to go back to them, is an obvious player in this matter. I want to repeat again, of course, our condolences to the family and friends and admirers of Keith Ellis, to say that we'll be doing a program, undoubtedly, about the work of Keith Ellis, a poet, professor, translator. A really remarkable individual, lived in our midst in Toronto, a really brilliant scholar. And I just tell you that there are organizations making statements, and I don't have the text in front of me, but I would refer you to them. The Canadian Network on Cuba has a lengthy and very important, I think, summary of the work of Keith Ellis. And there's also the Afro-Cuba web. If you go to Afro-Cuba web and into the Canadian Network on Cuba for statements of condolence and admiration for the Keith Ellis, who is also a guest on our program. And we, as I say, we will be repeating to we may repeat, actually, some of our interviews with Keith. Keith had some very interesting information about the development of progressive thought and success in South America, which has always been under in modern times, has been under the thumb of the United States. We all know this, everybody knows to say the Monroe Doctrine, which basically defined South America as a backyard or territory of the U.S. And a hint of this is to mention in relation to Keith, is he liked to talk about Paraguay, which is, oddly enough, Paraguay at the moment is a rather sad situation, basically run by extreme right people, right wing, and military. But in some ways, that's a evolutionary development which will continue to evolve and probably return Paraguay once again someday to the head of the line in terms of resistance in South America. Keith focused on a leader who had emerged there who really took to heart the concept of all people being born equal and trying and applied it to his society. He unfortunately was, his Paraguay at that time was surrounded by forces that determined not to permit him to succeed. I'm calling this a hint because I haven't done my homework today for in preparation on that subject. But just to say that that was something Keith talked to us about, and he pointed out that the Cuban Revolution had studied closely what had occurred in Paraguay in its early days, which really was a remarkable story. This is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT 89.5 FM Toronto. We are hearing that the Prime Minister is about to is going to be calling for a prorogue or prorog. We haven't agreed on how to pronounce it. with a until March, which would is, I assume that the other that we will hear an awful lot of screaming and shouting from Polyev, who is kind of like a wet rooster when anything comes up and has to shout from every rooftop. I wouldn't know that his prospects are all that great because, you know, it's the old thing of getting to know them. And there's some issues at play. One of the things I think we should all look forward to is the issue of Gaza, which has become kind of a quiet force across Canada. The leading parties don't want this matter to be discussed, or they don't want to take any stance. They don't want to do anything. They certainly don't want to join the International Court of Justice. They don't want to join the International Criminal Court. They all want to play it down. But actually, the situation in Gaza is much worse than it was. And today's news from Israel was that several leading parties in the country have sent combined to send a letter to the Prime Minister of Israel, saying, calling on the government to close off all water, food, and electricity. This, by the way, was the original crime issue with their former Minister of Defense. I think he was finally removed because there wasn't enough room on the branch for both him and Netanyahu, and so he has gone. But what he said in the first days of October 7, 8, 9, both leaders said things which are could clearly be the basis of an indictment, because they were calling for exactly that, no food, no water, no power. And it's manifestly a war crime if you carry it. Well, one, to advocate it, then to have the power to implement it, and then to see it being implemented, apparently not to the satisfaction of these leading parties within Israel. But to go back, I think the Canadian electorate is restless on this issue, even though our politicians don't like to talk about it. And there are people coming forward across the country who are conducting campaigns, and when the nomination process of the parties is completed, there's going to be a number of ridings across Canada where the main point being raised by the new candidates is going to challenge the parties on the subject of, no, let's be serious. Let's talk about breaking relations. Let's talk about implementing the international, position of the International Court of Justice. The preferred court, by the way, I have to say, I am not a believer in the ICC because the ICC is pretty much controlled by the Western states. The U.S. largely pays for it, even though they're not a member. And it's a really divisive kind of type of court. The International Court of Justice is one to which any member of the United Nations is a member. And when there's a question brought to that International Court of Justice, countries come. It's not individualized. It is nations speak. And when they had the International Court of Justice session regarding Israel, it was a very impressive performance by a number of countries. And again, we're not talking about an individual, some glamorous lawyer, some well-known this and that. These are states taking positions, and the import of it is much greater. Please remember that that the United States was once defeated at the International Court of Justice by Nicaragua, and they couldn't squirm out of it because that's a truly United Nations body. Unlike the International Criminal Court, which, United States doesn't belong to it, China doesn't, Russia doesn't, Israel doesn't. There's a long list of countries that don't, some for good reasons, some for bad. But the fact is, they just don't belong. So the question of jurisdiction and all that it's just too damn messy. It's not worth the time. The International Court of Justice, meanwhile, is very much worth the time, as Nicaragua would be happy to point out. The U.S. was quite, frankly, they were humiliated, and I believe it was, might have been Ronald Reagan or George Bush, I don't know which of them, but they both, they overstepped themselves, they mined a harbor in Nicaragua, and they were taken to the International Court of Justice. So it's very important to keep all this in mind. But to go back, again, there will be candidates. I know there are in Toronto, there's going to be challenges to the NDP federal party. There's going to be really outstanding, by the way, really outstanding people, because the mass movement that we've seen in Canada protesting what is happening to the people of Gaza, that mass movement has done what often happens, is generate figures, well-spoken people who really have, as the lawyers call it, the command of the file, and they know what they're talking about. And it offers the possibility of a new breed of leadership. And we all know that this system we have, there tends to be just a tendency, inevitable, I guess, the parties become, calcified, and more and more they're controlled by insiders, and there's very little discussion permitted. But when you have something like Gaza happen, the people actually begin to speak out and act out to try to bring an end to the horror. It doesn't require political leadership in the early stages because, frankly, the organizing is being done by the people who are bombing and massacring the population of Israel. Gaza. And that it's the seeing it and knowing it's going on and asking the leadership of countries to, aren't you going to do something? And then the answer is, well, you know, we're deeply concerned, or we're very, very, very concerned, to quote Chrystia Freeland. She's always very, very, very. So if you have three varies, that means they're really looking at it. They never do anything. So this frustrates the population. And that, I would say, is why we should be encouraged and hopeful about what's going to occur if and when this election does get called and the population gets a chance to show that they want a change, they want more decisive leadership on issues such as genocide, and to see it properly debated. There's something to be raised in relation to that. The foreign minister of Germany, her name is Baerbock, has recently visited the new leaders of, we're going to call them that, of Syria. Syria doesn't, at the moment, exist anymore. It doesn't actually have a government. It has a group that installed itself after the departure, collapse of the Assad leadership. Israel has entered the territory, of course Turkey has, but already the vultures are landing on the corpse of Syria, and Ms. Baerbock is one you really want to notice closely, because she's rather cold-blooded. She is the foreign minister, I'll say it again, of Germany, and she met the leadership of this group, which is very ill-defined, although we know their history. They are al-Qaeda people. So she arrived, and she has said in front of, actually, I believe, a European, certainly a European audience, and she said that bombing civilians is tolerable and inexcusable, and she does not intend to criticize Israel so long as it makes Israel more secure. Pretty cold-blooded stuff, which permits us to talk about her a little more closely, as we sometimes do about Chrystia Freeland. Ms. Baerbock's grandfather was a leader of the Wehrmacht and a Nazi. And I just have to say, you know, there was a process that was promised called denazification. It wasn't the Soviets, our Russian ally in World War II, that called for that. That was a common position. The British, the United States, and Russia, and, of course, France brought up. France wasn't as loud a voice at the time because they had lost their country for a time and were not a major factor in the war. But there was an agreement on denazification. And when a granddaughter of a Nazi has the kind of power Ms. Baerbock has, to me, that should require a little more scrutiny. I just saw an item today which examined her grandfather's record and pointed out he wasn't, you know, used to be an argument that the German general staff were not all Nazis, and many of them were probably anti-Nazi in the sense that they didn't agree with the party and its leadership. Her grandfather did, though. And I'm not talking about Christian. When I say grandfather these days, I think most people think about Christian. We have her in mind. But Baerbock's grandfather was one who was proud of the fact that he had read Mein Kampf and read it, you know, occasionally reread it to make sure that he was completely in tune. And the crimes of that war have never been equaled. I mean, in terms of just raw, cold-blooded murder in the name of an ideology that permitted it, which is a racial ideology. It was founded on the idea, Nazism founded on the idea of the Übermensch, the highest form of human beings. This is an old theory of eugenics theory that there was a higher racial hierarchy in amongst humans. World War II was fought to defeat that idea, which is one of the reasons that people rallied so well and were able to defeat it. It wasn't simply a political doctrine. It was a racial doctrine, and it's still alive and circulating today. But that's just to underline why this is so important. And if there's going to be an election, we should. I think people should raise this issue of why are we tolerating the return in Europe and Canada to apologists for Nazism. World War II ended with an agreement that there would be denazification. It is now talked about as though that was some kind of Soviet idea. It wasn't the Soviets' idea alone. All the Allies had agreed. But within 2 or 3 years of the end of the war, World War II, the West tossed that aside. And that is why, they tossed aside this denazification idea because they wanted to recruit Nazis into Western intelligence and into the Western military organization. And they began to show up all over the place. There were a lot of people. A generation ago, there were scholars, and I shouldn't say scholars, even journalists, major journalists, who kept track of the number of people who had been in part of the Nazi system, who found themselves in very, very powerful positions in the U.S., Canada, in the NATO operation. Of course, we have the 900 supporters of Nazism who came to Canada first class, you might say, walked in easily, and that was because they were to be useful in this system, and it bred a complacent attitude towards Nazism and the ideology. And to underline that again, from our point of view, the Taylor Report, this is why everybody should have in their home a copy of Family Ties by Peter McFarlane. And the subtitle is How a Ukrainian Nazi and a Living Witness Link Canada to Ukraine Today. You read that book and you will be immunized against Nazism and neo-Nazism. You become a healthy person, and you will also be able to help bring peace to Ukraine and Russia and to discipline NATO to dissolve itself or to back off. And it's a very aggressive strategy towards towards Russia, China. We do not have to have, and should not have at all, an adversarial policy towards Russia and China. This is all manufactured out of Washington, and that's why it's led into this unseemly association with neo-fascists. On January 1st in Kyiv, there was a torch parade celebrating Mr. Bandera. Bandera was our enemy. He slaughtered Poles and Jews, his organization. Canadian government doesn't protest. By the way, the Polish government does, the Israeli government does, others do, that how can this be? And we're never given an answer. Why are we providing back support and what to a government that tolerates that? Everybody said, oh, we're defending democracy. Well, if defending democracy is arming and patting on the back people who swore allegiance to Hitler, then you don't know what democracy is. Anyway, again, Family Ties, Peter McFarlane and Lorimer Press, that is a courageous publisher. Good for them. There's been no reviews of this book in the major media, despite the fact this is an outstanding, well-known publisher. We have a consensus. We have self-censorship in our leadership. Note to close out here, there's a, in terms of understanding who these guys are, they were called terrorists by name, and their reward offered, and now there's no reward, and now they're going to shake hands and give money to and everything else to help the man who is a bona fide terrorist, now called a statesman, in Syria. It brings to mind, it was a little limerick written in the time of Queen Elizabeth by a friend of hers, a poet. And he said, treason doth never prosper. What's the reason? Why, if it prosper, none dare call it treason. That would apply here. Terrorism doth never prosper. Why? Because if it prosper, none dare call it terrorism. So now we have our own selected little friend put in power over all of Syria, and I would say he's in for a ride, because the Syrian people are not going to put up with this.